School of Ahlul Bayt.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think throughout Imam Khomeini's time up to this second phase, where we'll talk about how he becomes an announced Mahdi Taqlid,
sure.
The whole Hawza was experiencing revolutionary ulema.
Yes.
You know, real revolutionary ulema.
Great
in the sense, like Fazla Nuri, like Sheikh Mutin Mudaris. Likewise, but one of the important revolutionary activity which we briefly referred to in conversation was the activities of Ayatollah Kashani, for example.
That's right.
And the endorsement of Ayatollah Kashani of the People's Movement.
That's right.
Of Mohandas
Mossadegh.
Mossadegh.
Yes, who then became Prime Minister, for a short
his
time.
His movement. What were the ulema trying to do in this situation? They were trying to get the people's involvement in a revolt against the oppressions of...
Because basically, say, we're saying here that, you know, we're talking about the ulama always being in the forefront of restoring the people's rights.
Indeed.
Because they're up against a very oppressive Pahlavi regime, both in the terms of Raza Khan, the father, and Muhammad Raza Khan, the son, of course. He gets installed in a coup d'etat in 1941 by the Allies
to remove Mossadegh.
And of course, in 1951, in 1953, they do another coup, to remove Mossadegh, especially because he nationalizes the oil industry and bring Mohammad Reza Shah, really to strengthen the Pahlavi regime completely in
but
Iran.
But what they found in doing so, they found that they could raise a puppet in the form of Reza Shah on one side, but they also found out that there will be an ever-long consistent confrontation with the ulema of the society.
That's correct, yes.
That they will continue to be a sore thumb in their aspirations to get the community against their religious values.
Exactly.
So they've always tried to dictate to this circle, the ulema. And all the time, they've always put a lot of pressure on the ulema to be subservient and subdued to the authority of the Shah.
Exactly.
And be an authority under it. But Imam Khomeini restrained from being so. And what happened, as we need to walk into this part of the discussion, is that as time goes on, whilst Imam Khomeini is learning all these things,
yes.
In 1961, Ayatollah Burujerdi passes
away. That's right. May God
bless him. And again, another senior scholar by the name Ayatollah, another Maje, who was Ayatollah Abul Qasim Kashani in 1962.
He passes away as
this
well.
This leaves a vacuum in the Maraje's circle. Mm-hmm. And there is a convention in the Hawza that when the Marja Taqlid passes away, he who is of a very high level of education leaves his doors open to receive condolences from the public on the demise of the Mahdi Taqlid.
Okay, right.
This is usually a kind of an indicator that I'm accessible to the Mahdiyat position.
Right, right.
In other words, people recognize him as well. It's not as if he's kind of barging himself in. Mm-hmm. But this is a convention that he who is the most senior in the community...
Yeah, both amongst the ulama as well as the people,
public.
That they recognize him that, he'll be the next
this
natural
is a procedure.
Successor.
This is a procedure. Mm-hmm. Imam Khomeini did not participate in this
procedure.
No, he
didn't. This was the extraordinary
thing. He left his doors, left his doors closed.
Exactly.
As if
he did the opposite.
He just went and condoled with whoever wanted to condole the demise of the Mahdi Taqlid.
Yeah.
People came and said, we want to come and give our condolences to you on the demise of that Mahdi Taqlid. In other words, we are recognizing you as the Mahdi Taqlid.
Right.
What is also interesting is some of his students used to say that there's usually, when the Mahdi Taqlid becomes a Mahdi Taqlid, he releases a book of practical laws.
That's right, yes.
Imam Khomeini did not release a book of practical laws.
This is another thing.
His students actually went and published these for him. He said in the sense that he didn't want to.
This is what we call a risala, isn't it? This is something that you
indeed
receive from a religious authority to give you guidance as a Muslim, how to be a good
indeed
Muslim.
Indeed, the practical laws of Islam.
Practical laws
of
Islam.
And that
but the students go ahead and publish
the
it.
The students go and publish
from
it.
From his seminars.
From his seminary.
Yeah,
saying that, look, we want to promote you. Mm. We want to let people know that you are the Mahdi Taqlid. But he said, no, you want to do it, you do it at your own expense.
Mm.
And he did not want to come into this environment of being identified.
He doesn't show, as you say, this desire to be, you know, something amongst the people, you know, is something that you come out of a worldly desire. This is a man who has completely shunned the world
indeed,
for what
and,
it is.
And you see, within the discussions of jurisprudence regarding the conditions, how a person can be classified as a Marji' Taqlid, Imam Khomeini, in his conditions of when a person becomes a Marji' Taqlid, puts in as a etiyat-e wajib, it's usually said, a compulsory caution, that the person who is being identified as a Marji' Taqlid, he should not have worldly aspirations.
That's right.
He should not have worldly desires.
No worldly aspirations.
You know, and that meant that Imam Khomeini was saying, even with the whole handful of Islamic knowledge that you have, and you've come to the stage of that you could be identified as a Marji' Taqlid, be careful, the shaitan can still come on you and
that's
say,
right.
Aren't I going to be identified by the people now?
I mean, this gnosis that Imam Khomeini has, you know, as you say, from the fact that he's also a mystic and he, I mean, this is something I find unique in his life, that I find this very rare in any other personality, that he's constantly consulting the Quran, constantly looking for God's pleasure, seeing that, finding the consent that is this something I should do that would please you and would be for the sake of Islam.
And it is. You see, we'll discuss later on when Imam Khomeini's exile from Iran. But in that period of time, there's a beautiful story about Imam Khomeini.
Sure.
That, you know, because being a Marji' Taqlid, you also have the responsibility to collect collect khums, which is the Islamic tax.
Yes, yes, yes.
On behalf of the Imam-e-Zaman, you know,
right.
Imam of our age.
Imam of the age, yes.
Now,
yes.
There's a good story about it, that there's a collector in Isfahan who collects money on behalf of Imam Khomeini as khums collector.
Right.
And usually these collectors are given the opportunity to take some money out of this collection as expenses.
Right.
So this collector, he would write to Imam Khomeini saying, can you please increase that amount of expenses that I can have in collecting the money? So Imam Khomeini replies to him saying, no, what you've been appointed is more than enough. So another visitor is going to Najaf, so he asks him verbally to ask Imam Khomeini to increase my provision. So Imam Khomeini tells this visitor to go back and tell the person that what he has is enough. So on the third occasion, he writes to Imam Khomeini saying that if, now it becomes a if, not can you, it becomes a if, saying if you do not increase my collection, then I will let people know that you do not qualify to be a Marji' Taqlid.
Unbelievable.
Now, you listen to Imam Khomeini's answer.
Right, right.
Imam Khomeini's answer is that if you do this, you would do me a favor in front of Imam-e-Zaman.
Very nice.
Now, he feels himself as a person always responsible to his imam.
His imam.
If he's collecting khums, he's not collecting khums for his pocket.
No, he's not.
He's collecting khums for the imam.
Very nice.
He's saying, if you reduce this burden of the khums on my shoulder, then you will be doing a favor to me.
A favor to me.
not belittling me.
No, that's very nice.
So, you know, it's really interesting to know how Imam Khomeini always used his opportunities to knock his personal desires for the betterment or the promotion of godly.
Because the natural response for anyone in that kind of situation would have been turning around and saying, who are you to say to me, you know, that...
Not only that, he might turn around and say, okay, how much do you want? So I don't lose my position.
I lose my reputation.
Yeah.
Quite.
Okay,
quite.
I'll silence you. Let me give you another 10,000 or 15,000. He didn't care.
No.
He said,
was
okay,
not interested.
Take people away from me.
Okay,
okay. Take them away from
take
me.
Take them away from
it
me.
It makes no difference because I'm answerable to God, not to you.
Very nice.
And
very
so, you know,
very beautiful.
Imam Khomeini had always that kind of self-building that it should be whatever you do, should be for God. Whatever fight you have.
It's the humility, the humbleness that
whoever
shows
you're
it.
Afraid of, it should be God.
It should be God.
Not he who is going to put pressure on you.
Very nice.
Like the Shah, he continuously put pressure on Imam Khomeini.
Yeah.
To the extent that in 1963, when all these things were happening, Imam Khomeini called Shah a wretched, miserable man.
And he certainly was.
And in doing so, the following day, because this happened on the 3rd of June, 1963.
Yes.
On the 5th of June, 1963, Imam Khomeini was arrested.
Yeah.
And when he was arrested, there's huge, huge demonstrations.
And we have to see that wretched, miserable man those words used by Imam Khomeini are not used in the sense that, you know, trying to degrade his reputation as a king. He's doing it in the fact of the akhirah, that you are a wretched, miserable individual on the day of judgment in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You've lost it all.
But Shahgat offended, he sent in his army.
Right. And that, this is where they ransacked Fazia, wasn't it?
Ransacked Fazia.
And they threw ulama off the roofs.
They did.
Rooftops.
And for 2 days, there were public demonstration and
denunciation. There was, yes.
And then Imam Khomeini was sent in exile locally.
Yeah.
And on the and the whole thing about the 15th of Khodad movement started, which is the 3rd of June.
That's right.
And the whole fact that so many people, there were almost 400 people killed.
That's right.
In those demonstrations.
In demonstrations.
And continuously, Imam Khomeini was kept under pressure.
There was a lot of bloodshed in those days. A lot of bloodshed by the regime.
But you see, they tried to put Imam Khomeini in such a pressure that public felt that Imam Khomeini was no longer around to voice their defense.
Defense, yes.
And Imam Khomeini continued to provide that defense for the public.
Mm.
So much so that, for example, when Shah was preparing for his 2,500th crowning anniversary
strange ceremony that
kingdom of
baffled the rest of the world, that what was that all about?
Well, they all came looking at a fool.
Yeah.
And the fools came to look at the fool. You know, you had Carter there, you had other people fooling around with this fool.
And the point that we have to make here, of course, with that ludicrous ceremony that was done round about 1977, I think it was, wasn't it? Was it round about that time, I think, he did that particular ceremony? But whatever it was, as you say, he had all these dignitaries called in, champagne flown from Paris by air, and the most expensive meals provided at the expense of the poverty of the people.
Yeah, they continued to do that. And Imam did not keep quiet on that situation.
Yeah.
Imam Khomeini put his foot down and condemned them.
Mm.
And thereupon, that ultimate final exile.
That's right.
Of Imam Khomeini to Turkey, and then to Iraq, and
Iraq
then to France
for 14 years.
Started its progression. And all these things were Imam Khomeini's main reasoning was that he would take whatever pressure the world would throw at him, as long as in the process of taking these pressures, God was being satisfied.
That's right. We also have to mention here the fact that, of course, during these pressures and these very difficult times that were being put on Imam Khomeini, although, as you say, he's now recognized by the people as the authority to lead them in terms of leading the Muslim Ummah, guiding them, as you say, as you quoted from verse 1771, you know, to be with the Imam of the time. But at the same time, he lost his elder son, didn't he? This sacrifice was also an indication to the people that how far Imam Khomeini was prepared to go in this path, that he was prepared to endure everything that was possible.
Indeed, and again, as we look, if we link back to what was aspiring him to do this, were the issues of Karbala, for example. He would have in his mind, well, I'm only losing one son, but my Imam lost so many sons on the field of Karbala.
Yes.
You know, so it's a continuous personalizing of those things which were a natural existence in the Shiite opinion.
That's right. Because this is what we're really talking about at the end of the day, that you know, principally the ethos and the politics and the this resistance movement that comes out of the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala, and that's the defining role for Imam Khomeini.
Indeed.
That it is a movement about Imam Hussein, and it's about guiding Muslims on the path of Imam Hussein to understand that movement, that way of not only resistance but to gain your rights from an oppressive regime.
And throughout Imam Khomeini's discourse on standing for your rights, he always used Karbala as the principles from where it is generating.
Yeah.
You know, for example, when Shah asks him in 1963, where is your army?
Yeah, yeah, that's
and
very
he said,
famous. Yes,
he said,
yes.
My army is in the laps of its mothers.
Yes, right.
What was this lap that he was talking about?
Yeah.
He was talking about the same Zainabiyyah
of
Karbala.
That's beautiful. That is very beautiful.
You know, that the ultimate message taker.
Ah, the ultimate.
That if the mother is given the opportunity to raise the kids properly,
yes,
then they will not ever forget the message of Karbala.
That's true. Absolutely, Sayyidina. That's,
you see, and in that sense, what was Imam Khomeini foreseeing in this situation? Yeah. When was the revolt that we're talking about? 1963.
Yes, yes.
When was the revolution? 1979.
Nine.
How many years? 16 years.
16 years, yes.
One generation of kids.
That's right.
You can see the foresight of Imam Khomeini.
This is the extraordinary thing about Imam Khomeini.
Now, Imam Khomeini is
seeing, he's taking it from the lessons and the legacy of Karbala.
Indeed. Yes. Indeed. And he's seeing that, you know, a child which is 2 years old, 3 years old in his mother's lap, 16 years later, he's 19, standing for Imam Khomeini's movement.
That's right.
5 years old, 21.
Sure.
So you can see Imam Khomeini's foresight. It's not just, I have kids in mother's laps. I have children who are going to stand to fight the Shah.
Sure.
So, you know, 1963's movement was a whole educational factor. Because from 1963 to 79, Imam Khomeini is training his, not training himself now. He's training the future.
He's training the future generations to make that resistance.
Exactly. And he depended on the backbone of the training was going to be the mothers. And I bring back again that evil concept that exists in the Muslim Ummah, that the Wahhabis are directly targeting the education of women.
Exactly.
So that lap of education is destroyed.
That's right. Because at the end of the day, you know, this is what we always remind ourselves and acknowledge at all times on the day of Ashura, that it is Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, who is the heroine of Karbala. Because if it wasn't for her, you know, Karbala wouldn't be Karbala for the way it would have been understood for generations.
Alhamdulillah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala put his own components there.
He did.
You know, it's an interesting thing to say Karbala would not be Karbala. This would not have opened without it being this way anyway.
Exactly.
You see?
Exactly.
So these are the prerequisites of the event that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had established that Imam Hussein was going to come with the whole consortium of people.
Even after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, at the outset, acknowledges the role of the women in the resistance in bringing down the Shah.
That on its side, and the fact that every time Imam Khomeini said, our movement would not be our movement without Ashura.
Exactly.
You see, and you can look at the same relationship. What did the Shah, Muhammad Reza Shah's father try to do?
Exactly.
He tried to stop Ashura from coming in the public.
Exactly. He wanted to put a public ban on it.
And in some places, they destroyed Husseinias where events were taking place on Ashura.
Yeah.
So you could see that the whole thing of the Islamic movement is as it develops on the back of continuous endorsement of Muharram, continuous endorsement of Ashura. And that's why when Imam Khomeini compares the Shah, he compares him with Yazid.
Exactly.
Compares him with Yazid and defines him as a Yazid of the time.
Exactly.
So people can kind of picturize the confrontation that we're in. That there's a Yazid of the time, the Yazid of that time confronted Imam Hussein.
Yeah.
Yazid of this time is confronting Imam Hussein's servants.
Exactly. And the people easily got that image in their mind by the atrocities that the Shah kept committing over and over again in terms of, you know, banning. It's very famously that he tried to stop the Ashura mornings again. And Imam Khomeini said, nobody stays in the house, everybody comes out on the street.
Yes. That's near to the time of the revolution itself. But you see, what is really interesting is that whilst Imam Khomeini is using the days of Ashura as important, Shah's regime is trying to convert the Muslim community towards anti-Islamic values.
That's right. You see, I mean, this was the purpose of that silly, ludicrous celebration of 2,500 years of modern. He was trying to take them back to a pre-Islamic age.
Pre-Islamic, and then, during this period, you know, you go to Tehran, you've got cabarets, you've got bars.
Some people used to
say that haram meat was more easier accessible than halal meat.
And the filthy films that were being shown on the cinemas.
The whole aspirations were to make the people anti-Islam in their livelihood.
Yeah.
So much so that these Islamic values did not have any essence in their existence.
But as you say, with the parallel with the Ataturk thing that had happened in Turkey,
indeed,
they were doing it at a much more aggressive level
indeed
here
they
in
were.
Iran.
But then because of that, the confrontation with the ulema was even more apparent.
Apparent, yeah.
That because during thing. It took time. It was one-off movement which removed everything as a change of government.
That's right.
Here, they were trying to change the whole culture of the
situation. The whole culture, yes. This was much more
dangerous.
And that's
what Imam Khomeini kept on picking up in his in his continuous confrontation. Mm. It was not one issue politics that Imam Khomeini was working with.
Sure.
It was more wider. Wherever the issues of confronting Islam started, he would take his extrapolation of Islamic values to confront them.
That's right.
And you see that throughout. And, you know, it so happened that once the Prime Minister of the Shah, his name was Prime Minister Hassan Ali Mansour, he called Imam Khomeini over to discuss with him that, you know, he should not be so aggressive with the Shah and he should apologize to the Shah. Imam Khomeini refused. And that type of arrogance to kind of get the ulema under control. And, you know, the whole purpose of it was to try and show that, look, we can control the ulema if we want to. It wasn't long before he was assassinated, mind you.
Right.
And those who realized that this was a huge insult to the Shia Ummah, you know, replied back in the rightful, in the manner which removed this evil.
Well, it shows the nature of the stooges who were in power. But the other thing is that we can't ignore the fact that the Americans had helped the Shah establish a very vicious secret police here in Iran, which was called SAVAK. Mm-hmm. And because of those atrocities that police were committing day in and day out, you know, on the ordinary citizens of the public, that, you know, the image of Yazid was, you know, quite imprinted on
Indeed.
The people's
and,
mind.
And also the fact that, you know, ordinary people in their own places who were being tortured and things, there was a calculated strategy in eliminating the lower ulema levels. You know, there were students who were being kidnapped and tortured
that's
and killed.
Right.
There were lower ranked ayatollahs who were kidnapped, tortured. You know, you had, for example, Ayatollah Talaghani, who was tortured.
That's right.
His family were tortured.
The students of Imam Khomeini, like, you know, Rafsanjani, Sayyid Khamenei, many other persons, Ayatollah Behishti, so many others.
All these
people were in prison.
The younger ulema, clerics of the time, they were all penalized for supporting Imam Khomeini.
Exactly.
And providing the public with some type of guidance around what the Islamic movement is against the Shah.
True.
And, you know, you got to remember this as a very important thing, that it was a field movement. It was it's really and truly the people's movement, because everything that Imam Khomeini talked about was talked to people from the masajids.
Right.
Everything that Imam Khomeini talked to the people about was represented to people in their local environment.
Sure.
So, you know, it was at that level of the people's level. It's something which the communists tried to hijack.
Yes. That's also a very important aspect, because the Tudor party, the Marxist party, of course, they were established around the time when the Allies who were fighting the Nazis, you know, overtook Iran. But of course, the Russians were establishing their own communist parties here, which kind of Islamic guise.
But you see, the Tudor party was the biggest communist party in the Muslim world in Iran.
That's right.
So we can maybe discuss that as a discussion regarding Imam Khomeini.
In a later program, definitely.
Program. Yeah. But to conclude, that what Imam Khomeini did up to his time of exile was that he really and truly forced the Shah into either exiling him or stepping down himself.
Very nice, yes.
And that was the ultimate thing. That's why in 1964, 4th of November, Imam Khomeini is exiled to Turkey.
Yeah, I think, what you touch on is an extremely significant point, and the fact that Imam Khomeini, may God bless him, is setting the standard right from the beginning
Indeed.
In terms of the fact that he's standing on principle, standing for the sake of the pleasure of Allah, you know, keeping us in line with the infallibles like the movement of Imam Hussein. And at the same time, he's setting himself as the example so that the people see from his sacrifice, even from his own loss of his own son and so on and so forth, that, you know, this is a no-nonsense man. You know, this is somebody who's really and truly for the sake of God's movement.
And followable.
Mm-hmm.
So you can really say, in conclusion to that, that Imam Khomeini is someone who is followable.
Yeah, right.
And that what he says, he will do.
He will do.
And therefore, if you follow him, there's no problem. You can do the same sacrifice as he's already done in front of you. Like Imam Hussein did.
Right.
to either show to people that I can sacrifice my son, so you can sacrifice yours as well.
That's great. Thank you very much for that, Sayyid, for that very valuable contribution today. And I hope, listeners, you enjoyed and benefited from the program. And we'll certainly carry on with this biographical account of Imam Khomeini's very revolutionary movement here in Iran in the next program. But may the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Trinity. In May 1945, a group of experts prepared a base to detonate 100 tons of TNT. They were busy finding an appropriate criterion to measure a huge bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The volume of the explosives should have been so large to simulate the main test. In the middle of all this, the differences of opinion between two groups of scientists over the secretive Manhattan Project grew larger. This group of scientists, who were supposed to change the mid-20th century's fate, could not reach an agreement on a certain issue. Most of them were of the opinion that after making an atomic bomb, the United States should put its power on display at night for Japanese envoys in order to make the Japanese emperor surrender by threatening him with the bomb. However, theoretical physicist Edward Teller insisted on testing the atomic bomb on a city to learn about its effects on its population.
The American people in their
The only thing that could put an end to the differences was the speech by then U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt for the scientist. It tipped the balance in favor of Teller.
Among other things, and at the climax, he said, "You scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost." Now, you know, I had the feeling that Roosevelt was talking to me. I was there when the letter was signed that awoke his interest in nuclear energy. I thought I knew he was talking about nuclear energy. Of the 2,000 scientists there, I felt he was talking to me.
Some people consider Edward Teller as a clear example of a mad scientist. Many critics believe that Stanley Kubrick was inspired by Edward Teller to create the notorious character Dr. Strangelove.
The report, my conclusion, was that this idea was not a practical deterrent for reasons which at this moment must be all too obvious.
Then you mean it is possible for them to have built such a thing?
Mr. President, the technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
After the TNT explosion test, it was eventually decided that the first bomb should go off in Alamogordo, which is located 230 miles south of New Mexico in Los Alamos. The operation was codenamed Trinity. The codename comes from the belief in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in Christianity. They were planning to launch the largest massacre of human beings in the name of Jesus. This 21-ton bomb was 200 times stronger than the calibration test. The light was so intense that could immediately cause blindness. It was visible within the radius of 16 kilometers. It melted the sands in the desert and turned them into green crystals. The radioactive effects remained in the region for 50 years. Before the bomb was tested, two other bombs named Little Boy and Fat Man were secretly taken to Oceania to be prepared for an attack on two Japanese cities. It was 8:15 a.m. local time on August 6, 1945. The first bomb, Little Boy, was dropped on Hiroshima by a bomber named Enola Gay. For the bomber to have enough time to flee the explosion, they dropped the bomb via a parachute. To make the detonation stronger, the bomb was set to go up 576 meters above the ground. Those who saw Little Boy explode mid-air from a distance said they saw a new sun in the sky. After the blast, two-thirds of the buildings in Hiroshima, including steelmaking and industrial factories, were completely destroyed. The only thing that was left standing in the city was the Hiroshima Prefectural Industrial Promotion Hall. The explosion happened on top of the building's dome, and as it was within the central focus of the blast, it was not completely devastated. The moment the bomb went off, about 100,000 residents in Hiroshima died on the spot. While Japan was in shock and the Japanese people had almost realized that they were defeated, then U.S. President Harry Truman announced that this bomb was just a warning. 3 days later, another bomb was detonated in Nagasaki, which claimed the lives of 40,000 people in that city. Next day, Japan conceded defeat and surrendered to U.S. conditions to end the war. In the following years, more people succumbed to injuries sustained after the explosion due to radiation. Even though the U.S. honored its forces who were involved in the Manhattan Project and the agents in the carnage were awarded, the events pushed the public to rise up against nuclear weapons. The harms caused by the newly invented elements were not always sudden and tangible like atomic bombs. The start of nuclear war dated back to 50 years before when radioactive material was first discovered. In the spring of 1896, Mary Curie and her husband, Pierre Curie, discovered the amazing characteristics of some mineral stones, including uranium. They realized that the elements in the stones emit radiations that are not visible but pass through many barriers. The radiation was named gamma. After her husband's death, Mary Curie continued her research in 1910. It led to the discovery of radium as a new radioactive element.
Madame Curie.
The discovery made her the first woman to receive the Nobel Prize twice. But the award cost Marie Curie a lot. Many doctors say she was a victim of radioactive material, especially radium, during her experiments in the lab. The possibility was raised in the following years because back then nuclear scientists did not know anything about the harmful effects of nuclear material. It caused bigger catastrophe. The discovery of radium among natural radioactive elements with the half-life of about 1,600 years left everyone in astonishment. The element's strange radiation added new color to advertisement in the West. Since the damage caused by the element and its radiation hadn't come to light yet, opportunistic traders sought to fulfill people's demands with these elements. They claimed that this dangerous material can help him live longer and healthier, so they introduced it to people's daily lives. They were used in the most sensitive cosmetic and hygienic products, including body lotions, lipsticks, toothpaste, and even water, bread, and chocolate. They claimed that radium as an ingredient in products is considered something positive. On the other hand, in 1917, the United States had just been involved in World War I. The Army needed clocks whose hands were luminous at night in the dark. So factories across the U.S. took up the job and started producing clocks. To paint the tiny impact numbers on the clock's screen, they instructed female workers to press the tip of the brush with their lips in order to keep it tiny. They were told that working with radium paint was not hazardous. After a while, some of the workers were diagnosed with strange diseases. They would go to the dentist to pull their decayed teeth, but not only wouldn't they be cured, their teeth would get injured. Things gradually got worse. After dentists touched their jaws, they would get injured. Many of them had cancerous tumors in their bones, and they would easily break. The first person who died was a 25-year-old woman named Amelia Maggia, nicknamed Molly. She succumbed to the disease in less than a year. The doctors didn't have an answer to her mysterious death. Gradually, as more and more female workers came down with illness, they pieced together the puzzle and found out that radium was the reason behind the deadly disease. Although, after 5 or 6 years in the mid-30s, advertising products that contained radioactive element and using them in products were altogether banned, their effects continued to last. After the atomic bombing in the World War, the radium girls and similar incidents like the Chernobyl disaster in Ukraine in 1986 and the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011 after the 8.9 strong earthquake, the international community rose up against nuclear energy. But the question is, why do countries, even Japan that was subject to the biggest atomic curse, not give up nuclear energy? Why does a country like Iran make so much effort and spend so much money to achieve such an apparently dangerous energy? West Asia is known for its wars. The wars were initially waged under different excuses, but they usually pursue the same goal, and that is oil. The United States' latest direct war in the region was launched in 2003. The U.S. invaded Iraq under the pretext that the country possessed weapons of mass destruction, like biological and nuclear bombs. But after years of war and bloodshed, no weapons that were used as a pretext to invade the country were found. Even though no unconventional weapons were found in the country, it was rich in oil resources that was hugely extracted. After the invasion, oil was extracted and used to push U.S. policies and economy forward. The U.S. dealt with Iraq and raised accusations that are somehow similar to Israel's behavior vis-a-vis Iran.
That Iran has another secret facility in Tehran, a secret atomic warehouse for storing massive amounts of equipment and material from Iran's secret nuclear weapons program. we exposed the site of Iran's secret atomic archive. It's right here in the Shorabad district of Tehran. Today, I'm revealing the site of a second facility, Iran's secret atomic warehouse. It's right here in the Turquzabad district of Tehran, just 3 miles away.
The Turquzabad carpet washing center was Netanyahu's last trick for the media to get the international community on board his Iranophobia scheme for, quote, possessing nuclear weapons. But the Israeli regime did not stop there at the media campaign level. To date, it has assassinated top Iranian nuclear scientists. He's someone who doesn't want to realize that based on numerous inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the religious views of the Iranian leader, it is not after nuclear weapons.
As of today, I can state that Iran is implementing its nuclear-related commitments. We have had access to all the sites and locations which we needed to visit.
So why does Israel keep insisting on the accusation and pursue such confrontational policies with Iran to stop the country from reaching nuclear technology? Is it possible that the objections are just excuses? Just like what happened in Iraq. How can the energy benefit Iran that the Israeli regime does everything it can to stop it from reaching the technology? It was exactly 6 years after the first and last nuclear bomb blast that a national lab in Idaho was lit up by only 4 200-watt light bulbs. Even though the EBR-1 project's goal was not to generate electricity, it corroborated theories concerning producing electricity from nuclear energy. The system, which was more complicated than making an atomic bomb, was later named nuclear reactor. The reactors could easily provide electricity for a city or more without constructing huge dams or consuming thousands of tons of charcoal and emitting pollutant gases. 70 years after the 4 famous light bulbs in Idaho were lit up, a little further away, Bill Gates, as the richest man on the planet and the owner of Microsoft, was investing on nuclear reactors that could work for 60 years after fueling just once. Today, reactors have considerably reduced consumption of oil condensates for producing energy. For example, the 1,000-megawatt reactor in Iran's Bushehr has saved 47 million barrels of oil that would otherwise be used for generating electricity in 7 years. In Europe, generating electricity is the foremost goal of using nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, but in Asia, there is a more burning issue, and that is water. West Asia is among the driest regions in the continent. It has only 1% of fresh water resources in the world. Many analysts believe that the next wars in the region will not be over oil. They say water is a serious concern in this part of the world. In this dry region, Israel has managed to export its agricultural products to all across the world, besides meeting 95% of its population's demands. The Israeli regime does not have underground water resources or many rivers. However, it has tipped environmental balance in its own favor by using nuclear technology to rein in nature. On the shores of the Red Sea, the saline water is desalinated for agriculture and drinking. As an example, Sorek, as the largest water treatment plant in the world, located 15 kilometers south of Tel Aviv, can purify 230 million cubic meters of water and tackle water shortage to a great extent.
This amount of water is equal to the water Iran annually receives from the Karajan-Latian dams for drinking and agriculture in Tehran and Elbourz provinces, with a population of about 15 million people. Even though only 20% of the land occupied by the Israeli regime is arable, today it has become an agricultural hub.
This is the finished product, desalinated water. And according to the officials here at the plant, it's a more complete water than water that hasn't had the saline removed, because in the process of desalination, minerals are added back.
It seems the Israeli regime and Washington are seeking to stop Iran from accessing nuclear energy, not because they are worried it might make a nuclear bomb, but they are concerned that Iran might achieve the nuclear technology that can strengthen its independence and tackle millions of Iranians' needs. Water and energy are among the most vital necessities in agriculture and other industries, and even if a country like Iran does not need nuclear energy to fulfill its needs, it still cannot forego the energy. If the fruit produced by farmers goes bad before reaching the market, it will bring nothing but financial loss and physical exhaustion. Many kinds of fruit cannot resist against natural bacteria and fungus as they quickly go bad. Today, the key to reach the market, especially the international one, is in the hand of irradiation. Thanks to nuclear technology, radiation technology has been around for 60 years and is used in the agriculture industry. Exposing fruits to the light emission of radiation for a short time can destroy the larvae and bacteria in fruits and increase its shelf life. Today, many agricultural products and even fruits like strawberry that have very short shelf life are exported to other countries. Exposing fruits to the gamma ray at entry points and quarantine centers of a country can't stop the spread of insects and pests.
We have to look at the taste, the color, the granulometry, is there some foreign material, and also we look at the microbiology. Spices can be contaminated up to 1 million bacteria per gram. And with the irradiation, it can reduce by 99.9%. Other treatment will not offer that kind of reduction. Irradiation for us will not change the taste, the color, will not leave any residue, and also is really lowering the microbiological count.
When we piece together different problems like medical treatment, industrial experiments, and other issues a country can resolve by using the nuclear technology, we find out that there is a good reason behind Iran's political and economic battle to achieve the technology. Today, if a country wants to guarantee its economic, scientific, and technological future, it needs to step in this field.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Rabbana, Rabbana, Ya Rabbana, Ya Rabbana, Ya Hayyu, Ya Qayyum, Nawwir Qalbana. listening to the program The Key on RIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for joining us here on The Key and IRIB English Radio. We would like to offer our condolences on the sacred month of Muharram, which is the month in which Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred. Today we're going to be speaking about one of the characteristics of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and that is the respect that Imam Hussein had was shown by the three caliphs. Imam Hussein is the third Imam of the Shias. However, he is also respected by the other sects within Islam, and he was also shown a great deal of respect by the first three caliphs. And this makes his the actions of Yazid and his explicit attack on Imam Hussein and his family even worse, because it also goes against the conduct of the first three caliphs, which is unanimously agreed as being something binding upon all Muslims, especially for the other Muslims as well, besides Shias. In the time of the first three caliphs, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was respected by them. The first three caliphs also they bared and they had patience with the objections of Imam Hussein to their political actions. By way of example, we can mention a story which has been related in some of the books of traditions of the Shias and the Ahlul Bayt. This tradition says that one day Umar was sitting on the minbar and he was giving a sermon. Imam Hussein alayhi salam was a relatively young child at this time. When Imam Hussein saw this, he told Umar to get off my father's pulpit, and go and sit on your own father's pulpit. Upon hearing this, Umar was amused at hearing this and said, "Well, my father doesn't have a pulpit." He then took Imam Hussein and sat him beside himself and showed his respect and his love to him. In the beginning of the caliphate of Abu Bakr, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was 7 years old. During the caliphate of Umar, he was 9 years old. And in the beginning of the caliphate of Osman, he had arrived at 19 years of age. So altogether, this era in his blessed life took approximately 25 years. This makes the actions of Yazid and his outright and explicit opposition to Imam Hussein, makes it something even worse, because it goes against this conduct. So we believe that Imam Hussein is a personality who is respected by all Muslims, and aside from that, he is given a special place within Shiite Islam. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the status and honor of Imam Hussein in the eyes of the first three caliphs. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Thank you. IB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah who is Ar-Rahman.
Allah
who is Al-Mannan.
La ilaha illa.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs. Before starting our show, I'd like to offer my condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the third Imam of the Shia school of thought, and the great tragedy of Karbala and his loyal companions. The topic that we are, inshallah, discussing here would be related to somehow to the doubts and misconceptions which are raised and posed against the important revolution of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. For that, we have invited Islamic researcher Sheikh Murtala Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers to the questions that we shall pose here. Before starting our discussion, I'd like to say salam to Sheikh and welcome him to the show. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thanks again for accepting the invitation. The question of the day that we want to ask it in this show from respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtala Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools, is a famous and old doubt that has been asked in the course of history, that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred by his awaiters, those who have invited him. There is a version of history that says that Imam alayhi salam was martyred by his followers, was by his Shias, those who have invited him to come back, to come to Kufa to help us and to lead us. We are lacking an Islamic, a pure Islamic leader. Whenever I face such a question and doubt, this reminds me of a famous word of Imam Ali alayhi salam, "Kalam haqqan yuradu bil batil." It's a true, actually, excerpt of the history, but they want to take, they want to misuse this, actually, piece of history to, for their own purposes. Anyhow, let's ask the scholar of the show, this researcher of Islamic studies, we have been asked, فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. This is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala ordered us, in case you don't know. Go and ask those who know. Those who know can be anyone. The first example and instance of those who know are the Ahlul Bayt, the real interpreters of Quran. And then, level by level, it comes to anyone who knows even one more sentence more than me. So we have invited a researcher from Qom Seminary Schools to shed some light on this issue. If Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred by his awaiters, then they make another comparison to our Imam of the age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Then Imam Mahdi is awaited by many people, namely the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, and they will be those who will kill him. Sheikhana, is this question at the beginning, at the base, is true first or no? Second, can it be compared to the issue and the case of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam? And are we expecting the same Shias who are waiting for him kill this Imam in future or no?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The first point that I would like to share is that let's imagine that those people, those Kufans, who took part in the tragic event of Karbala and killed Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, they were the 12 were Shias, and they were pure Shias. Let's imagine, of course, it's a wrong assumption, but who commanded them. I mean, those people who mentioned these doubts, they neglect the fact that the command to kill Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was issued by a corrupt person known as Yazid ibn Muawiyah, Yazid salam.